is the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And welcome back. I guess to me, it's the Supreme Court is passing down, is handing down decisions. Apparently, they're saying, fine, lethal injection, okay, go ahead. You know, the last guy that we heard from who got one of these shots said he felt like he was being roasted alive. Supreme Court says that's fine. That's the bad news. The good news is that there's good news, bad news, but bad news, right? The good news is that they upheld Arizona's Independent Redistricting Commission. Now, you know, as usual, the politicians didn't have the courage to do this. They would rather gerrymander on both sides, frankly, and, you know, have safe seats and all that kind of thing and not have competitive elections. But the good citizens of Arizona back in 2000 put on the ballot an initiative that would create something very much like what California just did in the last decade or so, which is create an independent commission that is non-political, non-partisan, that would draw congressional districts in a way that, you know, are as polygonal as possible. In other words, no more salamanders here, no more gerrymandering, just, you know, represent the people. And the Republicans fought this all the way to the Supreme Court because they wanted to be able to, you know, slice and dice Arizona the way that they wanted to, and they lost, which is great. It doesn't outlaw gerrymandering. What it does is it allows the citizens of a state which has, in which you have the ability to do a citizen petition, the ability to create an independent commission. So that's about half the states. So if you live in one of those states, you might want to seriously look at this. I know Oregon is one of those states. Washington State is one of those states. California already did it. Arizona did it. But that's surprising. So, and then the bad news is that the Supreme Court said that the EPA went too far in saying, no, you can't poison our air. And this is really, you know, quite astonishing when you think about it. Our power plants are responsible for 62% of the arsenic in our environment. Arsenic causes cancer. 50% of the mercury. Mercury causes neurological damage. 28% of the nickel. I'm not sure what that does. NOx, 13%. Chromium, 22%, another heavy metal. Sulfur dioxide, 60%, which, you know, damages buildings and things. All this coming out of our power plants. And so the EPA said you got to dial it back. What they didn't do is ask first, how much will it cost to dial it back? And so the Supreme Court says, and this is just kind of classic Republican, you got to figure out how much it's going to cost before you mandate the regulations. So this doesn't stop the EPA from doing it. It just says that they have to go through a different process, but it's going to be a couple more years and a lot more, you know, junk in our air and all this kind of thing. So meanwhile, we've had a half a dozen black churches in the last couple of weeks caught on fire. One was apparently hit by lightning. Another was a tree came down and took down the power lines. But out of these six churches, at least three have been determined to be arson. That's a lot in a very short period of time. You know, racism is still alive and well in the United States. The Confederate States of America and their official news organ, Fox so-called News, are alive and well. And, you know, I don't know where we go or what we do about this. So anyhow, a couple of things I wanted to fill you in on. It's anything goes summer, so you're welcome to call on anything. The other thing that I'm keeping an eye on here and a very close eye on is Greece. Greece has, I believe tomorrow is the day that they have to pay $1.9 billion to the EU and or to the IMF or whatever it is. And they also, today was the day that they would qualify for a $7 billion loan so that they could use it to pay off their debt, and then to pay off the loan, they'd have to privatize more of Greece and give it more of it to the billionaires and the big corporations. This is the logical end point of Reaganism. What we're seeing is this philosophy of austerity, this you know, sick and twisted philosophy of austerity spreading all across Europe. You know, it's been in the United States has been in the grips of it since 1980, the UK since 1978. This idea that Warren Harding campaigned on in 1920, less business, more business in government, less government in business. In other words, deregulate and privatize. And this is killing the developed countries of the world. It truly is. And, you know, I don't understand how the Europeans, particularly the Germans, keep looking at Greece and saying, you know, with a 50% unemployment rate among young people, with a 30% unemployment rate across the board, I mean, it's worse than it was during the Great Depression in Greece right now. And after a year, you lose your national health insurance after a year of unemployment. New York Times led a story with a woman who came into a doctor finally because something was breaking through her breast. It was breast cancer that had burst through the skin. He said, I haven't seen anything like this since I worked in the third world. Well, welcome to the third world. These are really serious problems. And we've got to figure out a way to... Unless the entire system collapses in and on itself, I don't see where these guys are going to change their policies, because there actually are winners and losers in neoliberalism, in austerity politics, in sequester politics. The winners are always the billionaires. The losers are always the working people. The billionaires and the banksters. I mean, the banksters drove Greece, you know, created Greece's problems, and now the banksters are saying, we want our pound of flesh. And the people are saying, you know, we gave you our left leg, then we gave you our right leg, then we gave you our left arm, you want our right arm? You know, it's like, really? So Tsipras, the prime minister of Greece, instead of saying yes to the EU over the weekend, as he was supposed to do, or last Friday, I guess it was, he said, we'll hold a referendum. We'll leave it up to the people. And if I were Greek, I would be voting to withdraw from the European Union, or at least the EU monetary system, from the euro, and go back to the drachma. I think that a country that doesn't control its own currency is a country that has no control over its own fate and future. Greece never should have joined the EU in the first place. They had to have Goldman Sachs, as I recall, come up with a phony baloney scheme where they took some of the Greek debt and made it look like it wasn't Greek debt so that they qualified for membership in the EU. And then the EU figured this out and started saying, pay back the debt, and thus began this whole mess. Well, that plus the recession of 2007-2008, the Bush recession going worldwide, you know, the consequence of that, of course, was decreased economic activity in Greece, too. But, you know, what's coming next? How is this going to come next to the United States? Well, the Republicans just passed austerity budget. Cut Medicare, cut Social Security, cut Medicaid, cut money to education, cut welfare programs, cut food stamps. I mean, the Republicans' budget that passed the House and I think passed the Senate, certainly passed the House, the Paul Ryan budget, is worse. I mean, it's the same thing, essentially, as what Greece is going through right now. This is what Republicans want to do to us. It's like the final, it's the end game move by billionaires, billionaire Republicans, against working people in the United States. When are we going to wake up? 15 minutes past.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Meanwhile, Texas, Louisiana, and Mississippi trying to figure out how to get around the Supreme Court's historic decision on the right for gay folks to marry. Welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. Richard in Fitchburg, Massachusetts, watching freespeech.org. Hey, Richard, what's up?
Yeah, Tom. Please let me talk. Don't just hang up on me. And let me comment back when you say stuff, because otherwise this isn't, we ain't getting nowhere. But I called all my congressmen and senators today. I want to know, you know, when an illegal or a person on a visa comes here, and they go to the emergency room and have to have operations and all that stuff. I ask them all, who pays for that? Does Medicare pay for it? Do people who pay, their health care in America pay for it? Or does property tax pay for it? Or did the Republicans appropriate money to pay all the hospitals in America?
It's going to vary, Richard, from state to state. Those states that have expanded Medicaid will have more federal funds to pay for that kind of thing. But you raise a larger question, which is people being here without documentation. And this is something that we need to fix. We need comprehensive immigration reform, and we need to start prosecuting employers who are hiring people who are here without legal status. We stopped doing that in 1986 when Reagan declared his amnesty, and then Reagan said, we're not going to put any more, rich white employers in jail. And that was the end of that. And it created this giant magnet. So, the answer is that it's going to vary from state to state, Richard. Daniel in Arcadia, Florida. Hey, Daniel. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Hi, Tom. I like the way Bernie talks because, really, frankly, Ulysses Grant, Lincoln's general, he went on an Indian killing spree. And Southerners have a right to say, well, you're a bunch of Indian murderers. And then the Unionists say, well, you created his first concentration camps. I think we've all gone wrong somehow. It's just a natural thing where we become self-aware that we have to get out of this this manifest destiny of revelation.
Yeah.
It doesn't have to be. It's like that Terminator movie, Judgment Day. It does not have to be this way.
Yeah.
Bernie's right. We don't need nuclear. We don't. The European countries have approved it.
Yeah, I don't disagree, Daniel. And we'll see. I mean, you think Bernie can win the presidency?
I absolutely do. Because think about this, Tom. The super volcanoes are long overdue erupting. If we were to set up a power plant from them, it would release the pressure and make super clean energy.
Yeah, that could be kind of dangerous, drilling into a volcano.
No, Tom, look, there's a super collider in England, where they're making dark matter and a dark energy,
Right.
I'm not sure about this, I know there's goodness and evil in the world, but I don't know if I think of God as some white dude in a gray beard, I mean, that would just be,
we're kind of all over the place here, Daniel. Daniel, thanks for the call. 20 minutes past, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. Interesting piece over at Time Magazine right now, time.com, The Radical Education of Bernie Sanders. And, Bernie, last Friday on this show, somebody asked Bernie about civil rights, and Bernie gave a kind of, I care about civil rights answer. And I said, Bernie, you're not going to brag on you, but I will. And I pointed out that, he had been arrested back in the day, and I thought it was SNCC. And he said, no, it was CORE, the Congress on Racial Equality. And here's the article. The civil rights, they're talking about when Bernie was 23 years old. And the civil rights movement also became a home for him. He became a leader of an NAACP ally called the Congress of Racial Equality at a time when most civil rights activists were black. He was arrested for demonstrating for desegregated public schools in Chicago. No big deal, says Sanders. You can go outside and get arrested, too. It's not that hard if you put your mind to it. He once walked around Chicago putting up flyers protesting police brutality. After half an hour, he realized a police car was following him, taking down every paper he'd put up, one by one. Are these yours? He remembers the officer telling him, holding up the stack of flyers. In his second year of college, Sanders made national news on a frigid Tuesday afternoon in January 1962. The 20-year-old from Brooklyn stood on the steps of the University of Chicago Administration Building and railed in the wind against the college's housing segregation policy. The young, bespeckled student told a few dozen classmates that they gathered there, quote, "We feel it is an intolerable situation when Negro and white students of the university cannot live together in university-owned apartments." He then led them into the building in protest and camped the night outside the president's office. It was Chicago's first civil rights sit-in, put together by Bernie Sanders. 1962, January of 62. Jeez. This guy has been walking the walk for longer than I've, you know, I mean, I was 11 years old then, longer than I've been paying attention. That's just amazing. It's just amazing. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's on your mind?
Well, I just wanted to say, as far as Greece is concerned, I think, you know, there is a prejudice, actually, you know, in the northern European countries against the southern European countries, and I hear it expressed. I mean, I've seen it firsthand, somebody who was married to a Greek making, who was German, making, you know, somewhat disparaging remarks or snickering, you know, about, you know, just how inefficient they are or whatever.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's interesting because at the end of World War II, they were forgiven their debts and they destroyed
Germany was.
Somebody pointed out, I can't remember who in the Greek government presently, you know, that it was like 30% or 40% of the infrastructure of Greece. And Greece has really suffered, I think, a lot. It's not a rich country by any means. And it was finally kind of in the 80s and 90s and, you know, up until this financial crisis, it was kind of coming out of the doldrums and really, you know, prospering for the first time. You know, since it was formed in 1840-something. But also, I wanted to talk about, you know, this ideology of capitalism as expressed through, you know, business management. You know, everything has to prostrate itself, you know, to this whole layer of administration. And I was talking with somebody, interestingly enough, a researcher over here at the University of Minnesota, who's from Italy, and, you know, she was telling me that half of her time, I mean, this is a person that has a postdoctorate and a PhD, half of the time she has to spend, you know, writing grants, and she says she has to use this ridiculous language that comes out of business administration schools to exaggerate everything that she does, when, you know, research on a lot of things, you know, it goes very slowly, but then somebody takes it together or somebody just pushes it one step further. And, you know, that's not something that's recognized in their, you know, value system. You know, and she said that she had heard one of the administrators, well, and this was in the bathroom, it was kind of humorous. She said that she was gossiping and saying, oh, all those smug, you know, PhDs, all those, you know, arrogant, you know, researchers. And it's like, you know, what a weird set of values we have in this society. These are the people we should be empowering, you know, with lots of money to find out, you know, what causes dementia, how to repair somebody's brain who has cerebral palsy, you know, and 20% of their budget has been cut. And I find it in healthcare too, where I work, the same kind of a thing. Our house doctor now has to take call for all the nursing homes, and I called him in an emergency, and he says, excuse me, I have to take a call from the nursing homes. And then came up, and he's so afraid that he's going to get sued, he ordered a chest x-ray, which was totally unnecessary. So this is the kind of thing, you know, to make things efficient under their way of doing things. When why do we need all these people? What is it that they actually do? A person who has experience could learn a little bit of business management and do quite as well, but that's not the way it's done anymore.
No, the way it's done anymore is the old boy network, if you're talking about business.
Well, old boy network and somebody who sits on the board of the hospital organization that I belong to, who owns five car washes, thinks it's neat to hire an MBA and then let them get their nursing credential afterwards. They have not even a clue of what we do. And they set it up that way. Yeah. And I think they think it's rather amusing, or that, it, you know, I don't know what they think. But
no, it's a religion, John. There's this religion that the so-called free market will solve everything, and that profit is always a positive motivator. And the fact of the matter is that in many realms, profit is actually a negative motivator. It promotes corruption, essentially. And profit, you know, for example, if a corporation is making a profit because they bought a congressman and he lowered the taxes on that corporation, that's not a good. You know, there's nothing good about that. So anyway, I'm with you. John, thank you for the call. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back. It's the Tom Hartman Program. Anything Goes Summer.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Back with more right after this. Minutes before the hour, occupying the media 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you, and Michael in Imperial Beach, California. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, Mr. Hartman. Okay, this is a bit repetitive, but okay, if the EPA says that this pollution stuff shouldn't happen, why would a person want to have a child knowing that this is what we're leaving them? It's unbelievable. Who are these people who actually believe that this is beneficial to our society? Are they the billionaires? Don't they have children? And where are they going to live?
Yeah. Well, you know, they'll live in a house with nice air filters and far, far away from a power plant. They always cite the power plants near low-income neighborhoods, and if preferably people of color in low-income neighborhoods. And but the thing here, Michael, is that the Supreme Court decision on the EPA was not all that bad. You know, basically what they said was, you guys never quantified how much it might cost industry to make these changes. And before you can make a decision about what changes should be made, you need to consider the cost to industry. I frankly don't think that's unreasonable. It's a little extra work for the EPA. They're going to have to do a somewhat different process next time to come up with probably the same rules, and they're going to have to specify what the cost is. But actually, I think they'll probably be able to make a stronger case when they do that, because they can demonstrate that the cost is not going to be that great, I'm assuming. So we'll see. I would not have this or any of these other things as a reason not to have kids. I really think that the human species is the most adaptive of any that's probably ever been on this planet, with maybe the exception of cockroaches and ants. And you know, we'll get through this. I really think so. Michael, thank you for the call. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris. Chris? You got to listen to your phone instead of your radio. Tony in Fayetteville, Arkansas. Hey, Tony.
Hey, Tom, how are you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm great. I just thought I would mention a different type of nuclear reactor, thorium.
Yeah, I'm familiar with them.
Yeah, and it's, while it doesn't generate as much power, it generates a lot still. It's actually considered to be walk-away safe. And the general thought behind it is that with the typical uranium reactor, you're always trying to keep it from going critical and having a meltdown.
Right.
But with a thorium reactor, you're actually always trying to keep it continuing.
Uh-huh.
So if you just stop, then it will either solidify or just drain into a storage tank below the reactor.
Yeah. The problem, Tony, is that to fuel a thorium reactor, you have to get a whole pile of thorium, which means you have to do a fair amount of mining with fossil fuels and refining with fossil fuel energy and transportation And wouldn't it be so much easier to simply capture wind or sun?
Fair enough. Fair enough.
Okay. Thanks a lot for the call.
I just want to make sure that you are aware of it.
Yeah, I'm very aware of it. Yeah, it's just, you know, it's these nuclear technologies are, you're correct, this and pebble reactors, they're becoming safer. But, you know, in the process of becoming safer, they are way more expensive than solar or wind. And there's still, you know, you're still talking about radioactive elements. Tony, thanks for the call. Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, what's up?
Hi, Tom. Yeah, did you happen to catch on BBC America the interview President Obama had with David Attenborough?
No, I did not.
Well, it was very interesting, and, you know, I've been concerned with, it seemed like President Obama's lack of urgency on climate change, but if you watch that interview, and he actually interviews David Attenborough, and he, you can tell he's very concerned with this, and he actually asks him whether he thought, basically, whether David Attenborough felt we had reached a point of no return as far as climate change.
Who is David Attenborough? That's such a familiar name.
He's the one who did does the Planet Earth stuff. He's like really old. He just turned 89.
So he's sort of the British version of Carl Sagan sort of thing.
Right. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't know.
And the president was asking him on television about climate change.
Yes, they had a long interview. It's on BBC America.
Our president.
And David Attenborough came to the White House for his 89th birthday.
Right.
And apparently he President Obama had watched him growing up.
Right.
And so he was very excited.
When was this interview?
I'm sorry?
When was this interview?
This happened in May. But wow. It was on last night on BBC America.
Hmm.
You could probably still catch it.
Yeah.
Because it was repeating.
Remarkable.
Remarkable. Yeah, I'll have to keep an eye. He really, yeah.
Yeah. So David Attenborough might have helped wake up the president back in May.
Well, no, it looked like the president really was, you know, he was more concerned about it than we realize.
Yeah, he's already
and
with the
he
program.
He was asking David Attenborough, who has this, you know, wealth of experience and has traveled all over the world and seen so many things, how he felt about whether we had reached that point.
Yeah.
And so it was very interesting. And I wanted to ask you real quick what you thought of President Obama's eulogy.
You're talking specifically about his breaking into song?
Well, the whole thing.
I didn't see the whole thing. I have seen the clip of him breaking into song several times, and I thought it was very moving. And
yeah, you should try to catch that.
Yeah. Yeah. I it's on my list. It's my weekend was kind of nuts. It's on my list. So and that was happening Friday as I was getting ready to head out of town. Anita, thank you for the call, and thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Well, let's see. Chris in Darlington, South Carolina. Hey, Chris. Fox News of Canada?
Yeah. Can you hear me this time?
I do, yeah.
Oh, great. A lot of things keep coming around on Facebook. One of them is Fox News, and its subsidiary in Canada went belly up, but apparently it was because Canada has strict laws that if you put something on as news, it has to be true. And if it's opinion, they've got to clearly state that it's opinion. And sort of, you know, Fox News format sort of loses its urgency.
Right. Well, it loses its ability to exist. You know, this was not related to Rupert Murdoch, though, was it? It was a different right-wing crank up there in Canada who was running.
I don't know who owned it or, you know, who was backing it or any of that, but I just know it went belly up. And you know, when you tell Fox News people this, they're like, oh, well, that's just not true. I heard it on Fox News, but it wasn't true, so obviously it can't be true.
Right.
I'm like, dude, wake up.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, there you go. We'll see how long it takes for Americans to wake up to what Fox so-called news really is. But, you know, they really need to be labeling their opinion stuff as opinion and take news out of their name because Fox is not about news. Fox is the official propaganda arm of the Republican Party and the remnants of the Confederate States of America. And it's just that simple. Chris, thanks for the call. Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's up?
Hello, Tom.
Hey.
Yeah, I've been watching this news pretty regular. the enemy of my enemy is my friend. I finally understand that now. These governments of the world are becoming the people's enemies with the way they're extracting wealth and putting hardships on people that's unnecessary. Now, what happens is ISIS and Al-Qaeda are not having very difficult time recruiting people because the governments have become the enemies of the people. And there's nowhere else to turn.
In many cases. I mean, there's also sectarianism here. Iraq had been a Sunni-run bulwark. You know, it was the reason we supported Saddam Hussein in Iraq, particularly in their war with Iran, was because the Iran is the Shia, Iraq was the Sunni, but it was a counterweight in both ways. They had Saudi Arabia off to their west, which is also Sunni, but it's Wahhabist and it's extremist Sunni. And Saddam Hussein would not allow that in Iraq. He ran a secular society. And then on the other hand, you had the Shia in Iran to off to their northeast, if my recollection of the geography is correct. And that's where they fought the war. A million men from both sides died. But the majority of Iraqis are actually Shia. And so the Sunni control over Iraq had been fairly iron-fisted. I guess the biggest incident was when George Herbert Walker Bush was president and he told the Shia in the South to rise up against Saddam and we would help them. And they rose up and we didn't help them. And so he slaughtered a couple hundred thousand people. Saddam Hussein was not a nice man, but he ran a secular country.
I understand all that.
But now that Iraq is in Shia hands, the Saudis are messing with it. Everybody's messing with it, all these Sunnis.
Yeah, I understand all that. But what I'm getting at is all these young kids from places like France and Spain and the United States and England, you've got people just joining, just not out of principle for their beliefs, but strictly out of anger for the governments that they've been under for all these times with the austerity measures. When you start taking everything away from people, they turn to somebody who's going to help them.
Right. Yeah, we'll see how this all plays out. Porky, thank you for the call. The enemy of my enemy is my friend. It's a lousy philosophy, but it's so true. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
15 minutes before the hour. It's Anything Goes Summer on the Tom Hartman Program. And welcome back. Judy, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network in Lewis Ford, North Carolina. Hey, Judy, what's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. I've got a topic that's been worrying me for some time now. And I don't know if I'm overreacting or what, but identity theft, we've gotten letters from different places, my husband and I, saying, oh, your information's been compromised, oh, 3 years ago, 5 years ago, and then, of course, the information being compromised at these major retailers. And it's very worrisome because if you have anything to lose, and somebody gets a hold of your identity and you worked your whole life for, you know, the little bit that you may have, you know, it's just like it's constantly on my mind. So I just wanted to hear some of your thoughts about it. If you think it's as big of an issue as I do, and or maybe it's not and I can just kind of calm down.
Identity theft?
Yes.
Identity theft is a huge issue. You know, there are services that will provide you. I think LifeLock is the most famous of them, and I'm not pitching them. They have sponsored our program in the past, but, you know, I've got no association with them right now. But I think they're the biggest and the best of the services. But more common than identity theft is they'll get your credit card number or your checking account number or whatever, and they'll make small withdrawals over time. And if after a couple of months you don't notice the small withdrawals, then they'll go go in and try and wipe you out. So keep an eye on your credit card statements, and if you can get them online, all the better. Although, you know, sometimes people have malware or viruses in their computer that log every keystroke, and And if you're looking at things online, that can be passing the information along to the thieves too. So, but it's a tough one, Judy. Do you have a personal problem right now?
I just don't like the fact that, you know, over the last 5 years, my information has been compromised. I don't do things on the computer because of identity theft. I have a post office box because I don't like leaving my mail in a mailbox.
Right.
You know, so I'm trying to take as much precaution. You know, I used to discuss my horoscope with people, you know, with my birthday, and I don't even want to discuss that anymore because it doesn't take much. It really doesn't take much.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, somebody who's determined, you know, will get through. And it's not just even somebody who's determined. This has turned into an actual industry where there are buildings with hundreds of people in them who are sitting there all day long. You know, the more common one that's kind of freaky. Louise ran into this a couple of weeks ago, is where you hit a website and it says virus alert, call this number right now. And there's an 800 number. Call this number right now to get. You know, to get this virus removed from your computer. Well, there's actually no virus on your computer. It's just a website that has locked up your computer. And you can't get out of it. You can't quit out of the program. The only way to get out is to turn your computer off. You turn your computer back on, you open that program again, that browser, and, of course, it goes right back to that page and locks up your computer again. So the way to get out of that, you know, and if you call the 800 number, they'll say, oh, yeah, give us a credit card, give us $100, and we'll teach you how to get out of this. And basically the way to get out of it is to start your computer, and then when you open the browser, hold down the shift key. At least this is how it works on a Mac. And that'll open your browser in a single brand new window that's not going to any page. And then just don't go back into history and hit that page that grabbed control of your computer. So that's what I know about all that, Judy. Judy, thanks a lot for the call. We'll be back. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Keith in Pelkey, Michigan, watching on Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Keith, what's up?
Hello, my friend. I was just wondering about, like, what is the latest you've heard with these proposed cuts to entitlement programs, Medicare, Social Security, disability, primarily, like for next year or any time?
Right. There's two... two sets of things that have to do with that, and they both have to do with Paul Ryan and John Boehner and the Republicans. The first is that they have passed now four budgets, I think, since the Republicans have controlled the House of Representatives. Every single one of them cuts Social Security, cuts Medicare, moves toward privatizing Social Security, cuts disability. I mean, they're just – the Republicans are all about austerity for people who aren't rich. They're all about tax breaks for people who are rich. In fact, astonishingly enough, the richest families in America are strongly lobbying for more tax breaks, you know, to do away with the inheritance tax. But here it is right here. This is from a Public Citizen. Just nine families could dodge $25.7 billion in taxes and perhaps as much as $54 billion if the estate tax were repealed. Half of these families have spent more than $1 million apiece lobbying Congress to repeal the tax between 2012 and the first quarter of 2015. So there's that. But so number one, they keep passing these budgets. Unfortunately, or fortunately for us, the budgets are not going to get past President Obama. This is why it's so important to have a Democrat in the White House. Number two, when Congress first started, they set their rules for the next 2 years because every Congress lasts 2 years from election to election. And the House of Representatives set their rules in such a way that they could not automatically move money. You've got two Social Security funds. You've got the disability fund, and you've got basically what you might call the retirement fund. And typically at the end of a year or two, one of those funds has a little more money than the other one does, and Congress just moves some of the money from one to the other. They should have moved them together a long time ago, but they don't. And so it looks like the disability fund is going to be the one that's going to run out probably next year, is going to run short. And what Congress did when they set their rules at the very beginning of the year, the Republicans in Congress said that they may not consider moving money from the Social Security fund into the Social Security disability fund. This was, quote, to protect Social Security, right? And if you believe that, I've got a bridge to sell you. We will therefore not see this hit the news until just before the next election, because that's just before the end of the next Congress, and the best guess from the GAO was that the Social Security Disability Fund is going to run out of money next summer or next fall. And so that's when that's going to be in the news. But the Republicans already set it up, and they're going to go, they're going to be sitting around going, well, we can't do anything about it. I mean, you know, the House rules prevent us from doing anything about it. And they're not going to mention that they passed those House rules in 2015. So in 2016, expect the Republicans to be going, oh, I don't know. You know, their favorite thing is to break things in Washington, D.C., to underfund things, underfund schools, underfund hospitals, underfund whatever they can that is run by the government, underfund the VA, and then sit around and go, gee, look at that. It's broken now. We should give it to some billionaire. Somebody should be able to make a buck on it. So that's my prediction for what's going to happen to Social Security disability. Did I miss anything, Keith?
No, I agree. It's sad because I have relatives that rely on these programs, and if it's cut any amount, they already told me they're not, you know, they're not sure what how they could get by even.
Yeah.
It's to that point. And, you know, like as far as Social Security, we live in a rural area, and you can tell when it's payday for these people. Because you go to the shopping malls and stores, and it's like a gold mine there.
Right.
So, you know, a lot of people rely on it.
Oh, yeah. Most Americans, more than half of Americans, are literally living paycheck to paycheck. And it's not a healthy way to live, and we as a society should be doing something about it. Keith, thank you for the call. Matt in St. Louis, Missouri, listening on Sirius XM. Hey, Matt, what's up?
Hey, Tom. You know, one of my particular problems is that my Democratic Senator, Claire McCaskill, she openly agrees with Paul Ryan's austerity budgets. And when I call her office and I say, I'm tired of going to campgrounds and recreational areas, for example, in the Smokies or somewhere in the West, that are closed due to sequestration. You know, the American people, people like me, we are affected by that. We see that. And I know that that's not something really heavy like privatizing your infrastructure, but I think the problem is that she agrees with him, and we can't really change the Republicans' minds, but we really need to find Democrats that understand this issue or, you know, show them the door, I guess. I really don't know what to do with my particular senator's positions.
Yeah. Claire McCaskill, we had Mike Papantonio on the program last week, and I think it was on the TV show, and I asked him the question, you know, Claire McCaskill was attacking Bernie Sanders without any specifics at all. She is one of the early and more outspoken advocates for Hillary Clinton. And Bernie's been going out of his way not to attack Hillary Clinton. He asked what her position on trade is, but that's a very different thing from attacking her. Claire McCaskill, on the other hand, said, you know, Bernie, when people figure out he's a socialist, they're going to leave. In other words, she's just calling names. She didn't say, when people figure out that Bernie wants Medicare for all, when people figure out that Bernie wants to strengthen Social Security, when people figure out that, you know, Bernie wants to reduce defense spending. She didn't say any policy things at all. And, I think Claire McCaskill is a classic conservative. She is a classic Democrat who, very much like virtually the entire Republican Party, is now wholly owned by the lobbyists, the banksters, and the power brokers here in Washington, D.C. And, you might call that conservative, and maybe that's enough to get Republican votes in Missouri, and maybe that's how she got to the Senate. But I frankly think that America is changing really rapidly, and progressives are gonna have a coming thing. And Claire McCaskill, she's not up for re-election next year, though, is she? I think she's up for re-election in 4 years.
No. No, it's 2018, but you know, Bernie, he's worth about $500,000. He votes like it. Claire, she's worth $25 million, and she votes like it.
Yeah, there you go. There you go. I'm not even sure Bernie's worth $500,000. But, yeah, thanks a lot, man. It's a problem, an enigma, wrapped in a riddle. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. New recommendations were released earlier this year by the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee, DGAC, D-G-A-C, an independent group of doctors and nutritionists who say we should cut down on meat for the sake of our health and the environment. In response to this, apparently Republicans in Congress are throwing a temper tantrum, as Lindsey Abrams points out over at Salon. Apparently, they're pretending their objections are all about science. The Dietary Guidelines for America are updated every 5 years, Lindsey Abrams writes, and they found that a diet higher in plant-based foods such as vegetables, fruits, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in calories and animal-based foods is more health-promoting and is associated with less environmental impact than the current U.S. diet. Now, this is the first time sustainability, you know, the opposite of Koch Industries and ExxonMobil, unsustainable burning fossil fuels, this is the first time sustainability has come into this issue. And, you know, it has a lot of people on the right quite upset. I'm guessing Jeff Steyer is one of them. He's the director of risk analysis with the National Center for Public Policy Research. Nationalcenter.org is the website for that conservative think tank. Hey, Jeff.
Hey, Tom. It's good to be back with you.
Thank you. Thanks for joining us. So I don't see anything wrong. I don't see anything wrong with this. They're saying, hey, you know, this is going to make people are healthier. And by the way, it'll be good for the climate. What's wrong with that?
Well, you were right when you said it's about science, and that's what this is supposed to be about. But it's about science, and it's about law. I follow this issue very closely. In fact, I'm the right winger who blew the think I'm the right wing think tank who blew the whistle on USDA's Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee for going beyond the law, and now Congress has listened and is about to change.
By going beyond the law, you mean talking about climate change? For God's sake.
Exactly. So let me explain. You were right to say that every 5 years, the USDA and FDA get together and put together the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee to update, to issue, what that committee does is issue the recommendation to the agencies on how we should change our diets. That law, which has been in effect for many years, and we've had many changes to the Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee. Yeah, you know, those are the ones that say eat more saturated fat, eat less saturated fat, fewer eggs, more eggs, the whole thing.
Right.
They are supposed to guide us on how to eat to affect our health, to prevent disease. And as you pointed out, for the first time, there's something else going into the equation, and that is the environment. Now, we could argue about whether or not meat, animal protein, affects the environment in a negative way more so than, I don't know, soybeans.
It's not an argument.
But that's not what this is about. This is about Congress telling the agencies, advise Americans on how to eat for their health. It never said advise Americans how to eat to have a more sustainable diet. That's not what the law said, and I called them out on it. And Congress is reining them in.
But all they're saying is, I mean, they're not saying you should eat this way for the climate. They're saying that
they
if
are.
You eat,
no, they are.
No, they're not. I just read the quote.
Let me
read it again.
Tom, you can read a quote from a left wing outlet like Alternet.
This is a quote from the Dietary Guidelines for Americans from the FDA or the USDA.
Tom, I was watching the meetings. I was monitoring the meetings. I've written about this for over a year. So you can point out one quote from a defensive member of that committee. I actually monitored the panel.
This is the actual conclusion that you're objecting to. They said, quote, a diet higher in plant-based foods such as fruits, vegetables, whole grains, legumes, nuts, and seeds, and lower in calorie and animal-based foods is more health-promoting, which was their mandate, and is associated with less environmental impact than is the current U.S. diet. So basically, they're doing their job, and they're saying, oh, by the way, there's a bonus effect. What's wrong with the bonus effect other than that, you know, you don't believe in climate change or something?
Well, I didn't say that. You could believe in climate change or not believe in climate change, or you could think that eating animal protein somehow contributes to climate change more so than getting your protein from other sources.
It does.
But we could have that discussion. But this is about what Congress is doing now is saying we told you to do it. This is part of this view that agencies can go on and do whatever they want, regardless of what Congress tells them. The administration is not reined in by the law. And the law is very clear here that the dietary guidelines ought to be based on nutrition advice to make you healthy. And in fact, the USDA, when it was originally defending these guidelines, advisory committee reports, and by the way, the Obama administration's Tom Vislak, the head of the USDA, actually backed away from them. But when they were defending these recommendations based on sustainability, it said that meat caused all these problems, but the science doesn't necessarily support that. But the argument here is simply, don't go beyond what the agency was authorized by Congress to do. So what Congress is doing now is just reinforcing what the law already is. It's not even necessary except for the fact that activist groups...
Well, no, the Republicans are trying to basically kill this because, God forbid, these people mention climate change.
The law didn't authorize the nutritionists to get into climate.
It didn't prevent them from either. And now Republicans want to prevent them from getting into that. Should that not be a consideration?
Tom, it should not be a consideration unless Congress authorizes the agency. You see,
right, and Republicans in Congress are not going to do that because they're in the pocket of ExxonMobil and the Koch brothers. I get that.
Tom, it's not Republicans in Congress. It's the way that the law was written and passed in a bipartisan way that it needs to be about nutrition. And now they're doing something.
And they said, here's the answer to the problem with nutrition. Oh, and by the way, it also is going to help climate change. They didn't say we should do this because it's going to help climate change.
Yes, they did. I was.
I will read it to you again, Jeff, if you want.
Tom, you're reading one line. I read the entire Dietary Guidelines Advisory Committee report. Not only did it talk about global warming, it talked about labor policy. All of the wish list of the left got thrown into here. Aquaculture, fish, sustainability, all sorts of issues got thrown into these dietary...
I don't think that this is the wish list of the left, Jeff. I think this is the wish list of all Americans who want a decent environment and a reasonable food supply, with the exception of the billionaires who can make their money off fossil fuels.
Actually, it's the left-wing wish list. There was labor policy. There was aqua sustainability.
How is labor left-wing?
Look,
aren't American workers? What's left-wing about being a worker?
Tom, if you think labor union policies are not dominated by left-wing politics, I'm going to...
No, I think they're right dead in the center of America, Jeff.
I'm going to concede that point to you and let your listeners decide who's more credible when it comes to that issue. All I'm saying is that the nutrition guidelines were dominated by things like not only nutrition, but labor policy and sustainability. It had very little to do with a decision based on the science in the law that was passed.
No, it had everything to do with the science. They concluded the science, and there's very little debate about this, Jeff, that if people move to a more plant-based and less meat-based diet, they're going to get healthier. And they're just saying this.
So then why did the committee poison the advice with the rest of the left-wing advice, if they're right on that science?
There's nothing left-wing about this. This is middle America. I realize for the fossil fuel billionaires, they want to slap a label on it and say, oh, my God, you can't regulate us. But, you know, there's nothing left-wing about this. People are concerned about their food. They're concerned about their environment. And they're concerned, frankly, about whether or not they're going to have a job tomorrow, about labor policies.
Tom, then we should pass a new law that says that the USDA and the FDA should get together and come up with what you view as mainstream American policies about labor law and acquisition.
No, I disagree.
All these issues.
Jeff, I think the law is just fine as it is. They found a strong basis for these recommendations
in diet alone.
And then they said, by the way, here are some other good benefits for people.
Tom, I agree with you. The law is fine on its own. The problem is the administration, as is often the case, is going beyond the law. And if, in fact, you were right, and this is a mainstream American view, Congress could get together, rewrite the law, and tell them to...
Except that you know that ain't going to happen, Jeff, when you've got the Republicans controlling both houses of Congress, and they're completely controlled by the fossil fuel billionaires.
Both houses of Congress represent the people. Well, if you think that's not the case...
No, I think they represent the billionaires. I really do. It's a sad thing to say, but... Jeff Steyer, nationalcenter.org. Thank you, Jeff.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I think they very much represent the billionaires, sadly. We'll be right back. And welcome back. Mike, watching Free Speech TV in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's on your mind? Mike? Okay. I'm going to put Mike on hold. He's on line 9. And let's try Carl in Nashville, Tennessee. Hey, Carl. Can you hear me? Comcast is doing it to us again. Okay. If I put you on hold and I can't hear you, and you're even if you're yelling at me, just call right back. Charles, driving through Arkansas. Charles, can you hear me? Apparently not. Fred in Trenton, South Carolina. Fred, can you hear me?
Yeah, I can hear you.
Okay, great. Let's have a conversation. Thanks right. for watching Free Speech TV.
Boy, have you been pushing the buttons today?
Yeah.
I just saw a news broadcast. I live next to the Georgia state line in South Carolina, and Georgia's going to be imposing a new tax beginning July 1st, I think it is, on motorists who are purchasing electric cars. And South Carolina is discussing increasing the gasoline tax by 16 cents a gallon due to the fact that consumers are leaning towards buying more fuel-efficient cars and electric cars, and they're not getting the revenue generated from taxes to come back into their budget. So that's the way that they're going to offset the people who are trying to be
right.
away from fossil fuels and everything.
And I think eventually what they're going to get to is a situation where they base the tax, and it'll be probably annually, on the number of miles that you drove and no longer tax fuels.
The other issue I wanted to call in about was a few years back I'd heard that Warren Buffett had proposed a investment plan to the U.S. government to come down through the mid of the United States, kind of the Midwest area there, and put in a series of wind turbine generating stations, and then go across the Southwest area and put in a series of solar power generating stations. And I'm just wondering why our government can't reenact the Civilian Conservation Corps program that they had back in the 30s and the 40s to put America back to work and help build the infrastructure. What would be wrong with a plan like that to stimulate the economy and give American people some jobs?
There would be nothing wrong with that. And basically what you're talking about is the government itself becoming the employer of last resort when capitalism fails to provide jobs. And the last president to do this was Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter had a program called CETA. And I forget what CETA stands for, but we had, Louise and I were running a community for abused kids up in New Hampshire, and only nonprofits qualified for CETA. And we had a guy who was a janitor and handyman and plumber, and he had all kinds of great skills, and he couldn't find a job. And he became our CETA employee, and they paid for a person's employment for the full year. And as I recall, he even had insurance. I may be wrong on that, but I think so. And at the end of that year, then the company has the choice of hiring that person or not hiring that person. And we ended up hiring Roy was his name. We ended up hiring him, and he stayed with us for another 4 or 5 years. It was a marvelous program. Nonprofits all over the country were using it. But, you know, Reagan came in, and that was the end of that. Fred, the net-net is that we have not had a president since Jimmy Carter who has been willing to say out loud that the government should be the employer of last resort when capitalism fails. We'll be right back. Minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes summer, although there's a lot going on. The FCC is considering ending telephone polling for cell phones as well as regular phones. The goal is to get the telemarketers out of the business, but it could also hurt pollers. And pollsters are, you know, this is one of the few ways that we know that elections are safe and honest. You know, keep an eye on this one. I don't, you know, I don't see it as a screaming urgency, but keep an eye on it. Mike in Chicago. Hey, Mike, what's up?
Hi. Good afternoon. How you doing?
I'm great. How about you?
Pretty good. Last week, I was heard a couple of callers discussing with you on how to debate a conservative.
Yeah.
And I was going to offer a suggestion of my own.
Okay.
I find that sometimes to debate a conservative is to debate them into a box of their own making. By that I mean you start with a premise that they can agree with. For example, ask that conservative if they agree that a government should be run a business. Most likely, they'll believe so. not to decide your beliefs about how government should not be like run like a business and profits and all that other stuff.
Right.
So you follow that by asking if they believe it's in a corporation's best interest to itself in order to increase profits. Again, I would think that they should agree with that.
So in their company's best interest to do what? To increase profits?
To invest in itself.
Oh, okay. Sure.
Okay, and most likely they'll agree with that. Now you pose a conclusion. You tell them, well, then they must agree that it would be in our government's best interest to invest in its people by providing them an education in order to create a better citizenry who get better jobs that pay better and thus creating better tax revenues.
Yeah.
Assuming that they believe taxes are inevitable, you've just gotten them to agree with you.
Very interesting. It's like keto, you know, where you use the other person's energy against them. That's a great one, Mike.
Right.
Yeah, thanks a lot for calling and sharing it. That's a great. I'll have to try that one of these days. Eric in Woodstock, Illinois. Hey, Eric.
Hey, Tom. Yeah, I just wanted to comment on Jeff Jarre saying that the USDA overstepped their authority.
Yeah, or the advisory board did, because God forbid they mention climate change.
Well, I'd just like to point out that climate change is about human health.
Yeah, you're right.
And so I don't see how they, current and future health. So in a way, it's kind of a higher form of health care. So I don't see where they were overstepping.
I'm guessing that what's his name, Jeff, would have said, no, really, it's not about health. It's about dietary guidelines and optimal meals. But if it was a little bit more broad, and he may or may not be right, I haven't read the enabling legislation. But I think your point is a really important one. I wish I had made it when he was on the phone, because you know climate change does affect our health. People are dying as a consequence of climate change all over the world right now, and we're seeing you know much more severe storms as a consequence of it. People are dying from that, and on it goes. So excellent point, Eric. Thank you for the call, Dennis in Edgewood, New Mexico. Hey, Dennis, what's up?
Yeah, Tom, maybe you can answer a question for my wife and I. We both always considered ourselves liberal or even progressive. And so every new program, every new good idea, if you will, that comes down, we've pretty much been for them. And now we're watching Greece and Puerto Rico run into their own debt issues in such a way that they put the viability of their companies at risk, their countries at risk. And we keep doing the same thing. Is there some secret sauce someplace that says at some point out there in the future when we reach 100 trillion or some number that it all goes away? Or
yeah. First of all, Greece and Puerto Rico don't have control over their own currency. And this is where the, you know, run your country like a family analogy breaks down. Families don't have control over their own currency. They can't choose to, you know, print money, essentially. They can't borrow from themselves either. And also Greece and Puerto Rico can't do that because they don't control their own currency. We can borrow from ourselves. That's the national debt. And our national debt has been higher than it is right now. It was after World War II. We paid it off by borrowing even more and stimulating the economy, principally through the Eisenhower highway system, but there were other things. And World War II was a huge stimulus, not as productive, though, as building the freeway system. So, no, the United States is not going to go down the Greek road because we control our currency. And this is why I'm of the opinion that Greece should go back to the drachma. They will go through a period of rapid and fairly extreme devaluation. Because they've, you know, their country, the wealth of their country has been basically robbed by the banksters and the rest of the European countries over the last, couple of years, 5-6 years, since 1980, basically. But if they were to go back to the drachma, then they could control their currency and they could put their programs back into place. The countries that continue to control their own currencies, Sweden, Denmark, Finland, Norway, they use the Norwegian kroner, the Swedish, I forget what it is, but they each own their own currencies. They have never used the euro. And because they own their own currencies, they've been able to deal with Sweden, dealt with a banking crisis in the late 90s very easily. The rest of these countries, you know, as long as you own your own currency, that's the secret sauce, as it were, Dennis. It's not the debt that we should be worrying about is not our national debt. And by the way, our government represents about 20% of GDP in the United States. In Canada, it's almost 40%. In most European countries, it's between 40 and 45% of GDP. A lot of that is because they have national health care systems. Probably more than half of that is the national health care system. But the other half of that is they have a much healthier social safety net. And it works just fine for them. So, you know, it's a matter of, I think, going back to the economic policies prior to Reagan that worked just fine. And you know, we can strengthen these programs. But, the point I was starting to make is the debt we should be concerning ourselves with is not the national debt, it's our trade debt. We have a trade debt of $11 trillion. We cannot redenominate that. We can't change the currency in which it's denominated. We can't print money to pay it back. And we can't, because it's owed to other countries. There's just, you know, about the only way out would be to massively inflate our way out of it. It's a problem. And it's why a seventh of our country's owned by foreigners.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
Say that again one more time. One-seventh of all assets in the United States are now owned by foreign companies or foreign people or foreign governments because of our trade debt. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Our geeky science alert for the day. The year 2015, it's not a leap year, but we have a leap second, which is going to happen tomorrow at 7:59:60, and then at 7:59:61, apparently, or 60, I guess we'll just hold for 2 seconds or whatever. The Earth is slowing down in its rotation. The average length of a day is actually 86,400.002 seconds long. And I mean, you know, it's not slowing down like in a big way, but nothing to worry about. Pigeons got nothing to do with it. Say what, Shana? Oh, it'll be interesting. Yeah. Will our automation system pick it up? Yeah, I think, you know, they're going to adjust the atomic clocks. So, oh, and we have a crazy alert here. on Saturday, CNN ran an entire segment. Brooke Hayes writing for UPI. On Saturday, CNN ran an entire segment on the possible sighting of an Islamic State flag at a pride parade in London. Just in, ISIS flag spotted at gay pride parade, read the banner stretching across the bottom of the news channel's TV feed as cameras repeatedly panned and zoomed in on what turned out to be a flag featuring crude drawings of sex toys. It was dildos and condoms and things and... Oh, yeah. I saw that one. That was hysterical. Anyhow, Alan in Glendale, California. Hey, Alan, what's on your mind?
Well, hi, Tom. There's a person in Southern California who is very popular, and I think would be popular in Democratic circles to become maybe, if not in like a vice presidential nominee, but maybe a Democratic cabinet member. His name is Pat Hayden. Do you know who Pat Hayden is, Tom?
No, I don't.
He is the athletic director at the University of Southern California. He was a USC football player, a television announcer, and he's a lawyer. He's a Rhodes Scholar. He has turned the USC athletic department around. It's known for kind of its sports programs.
Mm-hmm.
But Pat has come in there and personally has attended games and has promoted Title IX women's athletic programs.
Mm-hmm.
He is a supporter of gay rights.
So you think this is a guy that the next Democratic president should consider for their cabinet? Is that the essence of what you're saying?
Yeah, either for the tick. I don't think, I have no idea whether Pat Hayden is interested in this job.
Yeah.
But I think we need like the best talent kind of we can get in Washington, D.C. There's never been a scandal mentioned about Pat Hayden. He I think he understands black athletes because he's played with black athletes, and
he sounds like a great guy. Alan, I frankly don't know him or anything about him, so I'll have to do some education. Thanks for the call, Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Tom, I don't know why it is that people like your guests who are conservatives, and I call him a conservative, because he apparently identifies everything that doesn't agree with him as left-wing liberalism.
Right.
I don't know why people like that insist that the law must be interpreted so myopically and in such a parochial way that when you have the FDA and the USDA, the FDA Food and Drug Administration and the U.S. Department of Agriculture, you bet the USDA has an interest in the environmental effects on growing our food.
Yeah. Well, and one of the things that I saw this report just maybe 2 weeks ago, that as carbon dioxide levels go up, the assumption had been that plants would get healthier because they inhale carbon dioxide and exhale oxygen, the opposite of what we do. Turns out, though, that it's actually destructive to plants. They're not used to this level of carbon dioxide. They start growing a little faster than they should. They end up very spindly, and as a result, they fall over and die. I mean, having more carbon dioxide is not a good thing for plants, and plants are one of the things we eat. So it may turn out that our global warming is actually, already right now we're seeing our food supply endangered by global warming.
Well, that's like saying, first of all, I said this to my older brother when he said, don't plants breathe carbon dioxide and we breathe oxygen? I said, have you ever seen a plant with a pair of lungs on it? That's not the way the biochemistry works. And no, more is not necessarily better. Just as though if the partial pressure of oxygen in the atmosphere were to increase to, instead of 21%, 30%, we would be all dying of oxygen poisoning.
Right.
So more is not better. I listened to your guest, and I wonder if he would advocate, if the report came out and said, GMO crops are just as nutritious and they use less water.
Right.
You know, that's what they always are pushing about what's good about GMOs is that the effects on the environment. They use less water, they grow faster, we can do various things that are less environmentally impactive. That's what they say. And they're just as nutritious. So, you know, this is Lochner era thinking. This is the kind of thinking that the silo thought that says that, everything has to be separate. Like, back in the American Sugar Company, when they had a 90%, cornered 90% of the market, and the court ruled that, manufacturing sugar has nothing to do with selling sugar.
Right.
So that's not subject to, interstate commerce regulation. Or in 1934, when the court ruled that, mining coal has nothing to do with selling coal. So that has nothing to do with, regulating interstate commerce. So, you know, your guest is one of the conservatives, I find him to be to the far right, who wants to compartmentalize everything, look at everything in such a myopic and parochial way, only to have it his way. That's, if you look at things narrowly enough, you can see whatever you want.
Yeah. I don't disagree, and I don't know who the funders are for the National Center or what their specific agenda is, and I don't want to speculate about it on the air. But I think that for the Dietary Advisory Council or whatever it's called to say not only is eating less meat good for you, it's also good for the planet, I think that that's useful and valuable information.
And better for the animals that you do eat, because if they're as much water as it takes to produce beef and pork and not so much chicken, but beef for sure.
Right.
And go tell California that environmental concerns are not environmental issues are not a concern for the food industry.
Right. Yep. I'm with you, Paul. Thank you for the call. And thanks for listening to KBCS. And now for the other side of the argument, Derek in Chevy Chase, Maryland. Daryl, you're on the air.
Yeah, I'm here. It's interesting to hear that. I suppose he also, shows that he sounds like he had a little bit of law of knowledge, but it's incredibly dangerous and unbelievably unfounded.
I don't know who the he is that you're
your prior caller.
Oh, well, he's not here to defend himself, so let's not discuss him, okay?
Okay, well, Reagan isn't there either, but you cuss with that too. But anyway.
Reagan was president of the United States. That's different from a caller.
Do you believe that there should be any restrictions on an administrative agency that has been scoped to do something?
Of course.
Okay, so what if the prior caller said, what if this there was a Republican administrative agency, and they came out saying we really need to push GMO foods because they take less water, they grow faster, et cetera, et cetera, and that came out in a nutrition support. Would you be supporting that?
I don't know. I'd have to read the report. It's, you know, you're trying to build an argument based on a hypothetical that is, I think, relatively meaningless. The fact of the matter is that if you eat less meat, it's good for you and it's good for the planet. And there's
why is this nutrition panel commenting on labor policy?
Because nutrition comes from food, and eating less meat will improve the quality of our food supply. Cleaning up our climate will improve the quality of our food supply.
We've got
a food supply that's in crisis right now because of drought in the United States that may well be driven by climate change.
You know, Tom, you're taking the typical liberal totalitarian approach that anything that you feel is good can be promoted by anybody who wants to promote it. With the law.
Derek, you're employing one of the weakest debate techniques by characterizing me as saying that everything applies when I'm speaking in a very narrow area. You're just a typical liberal. You're trying to name call me. It doesn't work, Derek. It really doesn't work. Todd in Fullerton, California. Hey, Todd, what's on your mind?
Hi, Tom. Quick question for you. Doesn't Germany owe Greece, $10, $15, $20 billion?
Yeah, I think it's more than that, but Greece has not been able to collect on that since World War II. The official position of the German government is that that's money that the Nazis owed Greece, not that they owe Greece.
So why not just... I mean, isn't it something that they could bring up?
They have been bringing it up. Cyprus has brought it up several times. He would like to collect that money, and the Germans just kind of basically laugh at him.
Okay. Also, one other thing for revisionist history, the Fox channels has taken over History Channel and Science channels, and they've changed the programming, and you can see really clearly differences in
the History
in
Channel
really
and the Science
happened.
Channel are now owned by News Corp?
Yes.
I
believe so. That's what I read.
Yeah, Shano's fact-checking that. I'm very skeptical about that. I thought both were owned by NBC, but I could be wrong. We'll find out, and I'll let you know after the break. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
Okay, the Science Channel and the History Channel are owned by Hearst and Walt Disney, not by Fox. We'll be back. Welcome back. 15 minutes before the hour. Howard in Coriopolis, Pennsylvania, watching Free Speech TV on Dish. Hey, Howard, what's on your mind?
Yes, Tom, this is something I've never heard you mention or Bernie Sanders mentioned. There is a direct link between our jobs going to China and our young kids in the cities with no jobs getting in trouble and going down a life of crime.
Absolutely. This is the point that Bernie makes and that I make about how our trade policies not only have decimated the American middle class, but they've double decimated particularly people of color in cities that used to be manufacturing centers like Baltimore, and now the manufacturing's all gone and there's nothing coming in to replace it.
Okay, I've never heard you mention it, but...
You still there, Howard?
Yes, I've never heard you mention it, so yeah, I'm thankful that you have brought that subject up.
Oh, I think, absolutely. And I have said this, but apparently not often enough, and it's really worth repeating. If the textile manufacturers who used to dominate Baltimore, they made clothing there, they made shirts, they made socks, they made underwear, they made all kinds of things. There was also heavy manufacturing in Baltimore as well. If those manufacturing plants were still in Baltimore rather than being in China and Vietnam and Mexico now as a result of our trade deals, if those plants were still there, you would not have, 50-60% unemployment in these very poor communities of color. And instead, you'd have relatively normal unemployment levels. And, people who have a job tend not to get into trouble, A. And B, the way that a lot of these folks are getting into trouble is by trying to be capitalists. It's just that there's, you know, society has blocked them out of any normal capitalism. So the capitalism that they're engaging in is loan sharking, prostitution, and selling drugs. I mean, you know, it's good capitalist stuff. It's just outside the law. And, you know, particularly the selling the drugs. And when you see a community where, you know, these kinds of crimes are, you know, in large number, that's a community that needs a factory. That's a community that needs jobs. Human, you know, whether people, regardless of race, people are pretty much all the same. You know, I mean, Ben Franklin said, you know, an idle hands are the devil's plaything. I mean, we've known for hundreds of years that the, you know, the best way to prevent people from getting into trouble is to keep them busy at something that, you know, they're pleased to be busy at, and getting a paycheck every other week is a big, you know, incentive. So, yeah, I think, you know, I think Howard...
Yeah, it's a pro-family thing.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, before Reagan, you know, my dad worked 40 years in a tool and die shop. He had a good union job. He had good union pay. He was able to buy a new car every 3 years, sometimes every 2 years. He was able to take us on vacation for a couple of weeks every year. He was able to pay off his house in 30 years, which he had, you know, borrowed the money on the GI Bill, you know, as a World War II vet.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, that used to be America. When Ronald Reagan came into office, the biggest employer in the United States was General Motors. And in today's dollars, they were paying $54 an hour to people like my dad. And today, the biggest employer in the United States, now 35 years of Reaganomics and Clintonomics and free trade, the biggest employer in the United States is Walmart, and their average pay is $9 an hour. That's a serious problem, a serious difference. Howard, thank you for the call. And Walmart doesn't even sell things made in the United States, by and large. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by free-don.org. Today, by the way, is the anniversary 9 years ago of Don Siegelman's conviction. And if you're on his newsletter mailing list, it's a fascinating email that just went out. It's at free-don.org. And by Alan Ratner's charity, goatsfortheoldgoat.com. So let's go to the White House to Victoria Jones. Hey, Victoria.
Hey, Tom.
So what's up?
Josh Earnest, the White House spokesman, said today that they view it as really essential that Greece stays in the Eurozone. Greece has a payment, a big bailout payment that is due tomorrow, and it doesn't look like they're going to make it. Global stock markets really groaned today after Greece closed its banks for a week amid fears that the country is headed toward default. Stocks did slump on Wall Street. Between the Dow Jones, the Standard & Poor's, and the NASDAQ, they're down about 1.3% between them right now. European stocks all closed down between 3 and 4% average between them.
Right.
So generally speaking, things are not looking good globally because Asian stocks were also hit. So it basically is hitting everybody, and there is grave concern about what will happen to Greece and whether that would have a knock-on effect to other struggling countries in Europe, like Spain, like Ireland, like Portugal.
Right. And is there any kind of consensus?
Probably
no, not.
There isn't a consensus.
Yeah. Okay. So it's going to be very interesting to watch what happens over the next 24 hours in particular.
Yeah. We had the final day of Supreme Court decisions today. So we had several, so I'll do them in brief.
Okay.
Supreme Court upheld. Now, this was a surprise one. So there's one surprise. I'll do the surprise first. 5-4 upheld Arizona congressional districts drawn by an independent commission and rejected a constitutional challenge from Republican lawmakers.
Right, because Arizona did essentially the same thing California did. The legislature didn't do this. The people did by ballot initiative. They said, no more gerrymandering. We want districts that are all basically, you know, polygons and that just reflect the people rather than, you know, having politicians redraw districts to get safe seats.
Right, and Ruth Bader Ginsburg, writing for the court, basically said, because even though they were saying, well, the Constitution gives the legislature the right to do this, basically said, well, there's no constitutional barrier to a state's empowerment of its people by embracing that form of lawmaking. Arizona voters sought to restore the core principle that the voters should choose their representatives, not the other way round.
Was the swing vote Kennedy?
Yes, the swing vote was Kennedy.
Okay, very interesting.
Yeah. A deeply divided Supreme Court, this was a bitter one, upheld the use of controversial drug midazolam in lethal injections today.
Mm-hmm.
There were four dissents, and we heard from them. Now, two dissenting justices said for the first time they think it's highly likely the death penalty itself is unconstitutional.
Wow.
Including Stephen Breyer. Yeah, he said he thinks it's likely that it is unconstitutional, and he said that.
Well,
and retired Justice John Paul Stevens, who announced his own opposition to capital punishment late in his court tenure, was in the courtroom today.
Well, the Supreme Court had ruled that the capital punishment was unconstitutional, and then they reversed themselves in, what, 76, 86? I forget the year.
Yeah, I don't know the year.
Yeah.
I don't know the year, but they basically ruled 5-4 that, and it was, I'm sure you remember the arguments, it was pretty vicious during the arguments. They voted, in this case from Oklahoma, that this sedative can be used in executions without violating the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. This sedative is said to cause excruciating screaming pain. It's the first in a three-drug cocktail. The next drug is the paralytic. So that if it does cause this pain, the next drug paralyzes you so that you can't cry out.
Right.
In dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor said, under the court's new rule, it would not matter whether the state intended to use midazolam or instead to have petitioners drawn and quartered, slowly tortured to death, or actually burned at the stake.
Wow. I don't know, you know, there's all this controversy about these drugs and they can't get them and all this kind of thing, and I'm a total opponent of the death penalty, but it seems like it would be so simple to simply use an overdose of morphine or one of the barbiturate drugs. But, you know, I shouldn't even recommend that. Pardon?
It seems simple.
Yeah, yeah, I mean, this is how they put down animals, you know.
It seems simple.
But we've got to make it complicated, apparently. We want people to hurt before they die.
It's interesting. Interesting decision. The Supreme Court will continue allowing residents of Arizona and Kansas to register to vote using a federal form without having to provide proof of citizenship. The justices today rejected an appeal from Republican officials in those two states who've sought to enforce laws requiring new voters to submit a birth certificate, passport, or other papers documenting U.S. citizenship.
That's interesting. Now, they can keep in place their laws against citizens, non-citizens voting, in which case if somebody registered to vote who wasn't a citizen, they would have committed a crime and then they could be prosecuted. This is, again, you know, one of these problems in search of, you know, problems that aren't really problems, you know, or solutions in search of a problem, I guess is the phrase.
That's exactly what I think the plaintiffs were saying.
Yeah.
Well, not the plaintiffs,
the
other, yeah. The Supreme Court also ruled the Obama administration, 5-4, should have considered compliance costs when it decided to limit emissions of mercury and other hazardous air pollutants, mainly from coal-fired power plants. This is a setback for the government that leaves the legal status of the regulation in limbo.
Hmm.
So it's a setback for the EPA. The rule stays in effect with the case returning to an appeals court, which will decide whether or not it should be thrown out.
Fascinating, fascinating. Victoria Jones of the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. Thank you, Victoria.
Thank you, Tom.
Have a great day and have fun there at the White House.
Thank you.
We'll be back with Anything Goes Summer right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. is the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. 6 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Anything goes summer. A couple of things I wanted to share with you. One of our listeners heard me talking about how Bernie Sanders, back when he was in his 20s, was marching for integration of housing in Chicago and at the University of Chicago, got arrested in one of those events, and was working with the Congress on racial equality. And the guy says, thanks for underscoring the activities of Bernie Sanders when he was 22 years old. I value his work, too. I thought you'd be interested in covering some of the same things that Hillary has been doing since her teen years. He says, while at Wesley College in Massachusetts, she became head of the local chapter of the Young Republicans. While there, she slowly turned leftward in her politics, campaigning for Eugene McCarthy for president, organizing the school's first teach-ins on the Vietnam War. She wrote her senior thesis on poverty and community development, graduated in 69 with a degree in poli-sci. In the summer of 70, she heard Marion Wright Edelman speak, which led her into the Children's Defense Fund. She interviewed the families of migrant laborers and reported her findings to Walter Scott's Senate subcommittee. Thus began a lifelong friendship and commitment to children's issues. In 1974, she went to Washington, D.C. as one of only three women out of 43 lawyers to work on the inquiry into the possible impeachment of Richard Nixon. In 1979, as a senior, she interviewed Saul Alinsky. Her conclusion, if the ideals Alinsky espouses were actualized, the result would be a social revolution. Now, these are the kind of things that will get you on the conspiracy TV shows. You know, it's like, oh, here's proof that she's a communist. No, sorry, not really. One of Hillary's Yale professors, Thomas Emerson, known as Tommy the Commie, introduced her to the aforementioned Charles Gary. Gary helped Hillary get personally involved in the defense of several Black Panthers, including the notorious Bobby Seale. Anyhow, it goes on. You know, as I've said before, I think that I personally believe that Bernie Sanders would be a better president than Hillary Clinton. That said, if Hillary Clinton is the nominee of the Democratic Party, I will enthusiastically work for her and vote for her. I've been saying this all along. But let's see who wins the nomination first. And I'm not going to trash Hillary. Bernie won't put down Hillary. I realize, you know, Hillary's surrogate Claire McCaskill has been calling names of Bernie, but you know, I'm not going to do that. I'm not going to go there. And I don't think any of us should. I think we should, you know, put your best foot forward and let's see where it goes. Today at 2 o'clock, 2:05, which was 5 minutes ago, the President of the United States signed the TPA, the trade, he signed Fast Track. Just so you know, he's also signing bills to renew trade adjustment assistance and extend preferential duty treatment for sub-Saharan Africa. This is an email from Public Citizen. And another very interesting, a couple of interesting things here. Nine families in the United States have spent millions of dollars on buying members of Congress here in Washington, D.C. in order to save themselves some money, perhaps as much as $54 billion. Nine families, $54 billion. Because they want to repeal the estate tax. And, you know, they've apparently with the millions of dollars they've spent, they've been able to buy a number of legislators. The U.S. House of Representatives passed a repeal of the estate tax in April. Right? All the Republicans voted for it. Now, it won't be law because the president won't sign it, but the Republicans passed it. The bill, sponsored by U.S. Representative Kevin Brady, Republican from Texas, had more than 100 co-sponsors. But really, it's these nine families who are pumping out the money. It's really quite extraordinary. And 9 years ago today, I mentioned this briefly, but I want to get into it at a little more length. 9 years ago today, June 29th, Don Siegelman was convicted. He writes to me, he said, you may remember that day, two hung juries. The foreman sent a message to Judge Fuller that the jury can't reach a decision. Prosecutor Fagan said he would replace jurors who were refusing to deliberate. So Fuller orders the marshals to bring the jury in so he can talk to them. It's the weekend before the 4th of July holiday, 2006. The jury has been partially sequestered since May. Many jurors were living in a Montgomery hotel. They needed to get back to their jobs, and they wanted to be with their families. Fuller said to the jury, quote, "Look, I got a lifetime job. I can keep you here until next July if you want me to. Bring me a verdict or a partial verdict." And the jury gave Fuller what he asked for, a partial verdict. Not guilty of about 96% of the charges. Later, one juror filed a letter with the court and the lawyers saying that things were not right in the jury room. This juror claimed that one juror brought in news on the trial under her coat, hidden from the U.S. Marshals. Another brought in papers from the Internet. This juror said he felt undue pressure from some of the other jurors and regretted caving into the pressure put on him by Judge Fuller. He said, and I quote, "I told the other jurors just to vote me however they needed to vote me so I could get home. That was wrong, and I started feeling badly. I can't sleep. I've talked to my preacher several times, and he suggested I speak with a lawyer, and that's why I'm filing this letter." America's political prisoner, Don Siegelman. Go to free-don.org. You can see the whole story and watch this 60-minute special. It is astonishing. It is truly astonishing. And we haven't, well, yeah, I guess we have talked somewhat. I mean, on Friday, the decision came down from the Supreme Court that legalized gay marriage all across the United States. I did the brunch with Bernie Hour, and then I was going to head out to the airport. Ended up in the hospital instead, but that's a whole long story. I'm fine. But the opportunity to discuss this, you and I have not had. And I'm really pleased that the Supreme Court made gay marriage legal all across the United States, on the one hand. On the other hand, I'm really concerned that this might, probably won't, because there's such a broad and growing consensus in favor of gay marriage, but that this might go the way of Roe v. Wade, which is where the Supreme Court wrote a decision that essentially was writing law. They came up with the three trimesters of pregnancy, three-month periods, and said there's different rules for each one of these 3 months, and these are the rules of the road now in the future. Now, that's not the Supreme Court's job. Their job is to be the court of final appeal, not to be writing laws. And so as much as I agree with the Roe v. Wade decision, and, you know, if the way that I think this should be done had happened, more women would have died from back alley abortion. So it's really, really hard to advocate for this. But the court should have said to Mrs. Roe, yes, your abortion is legal. No problem. Rather than striking down the law and then just let, you know, 20 people, 50 people, 100 people, people from all over the country start filing briefs to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court simply saying, yeah, you're legal, you're legal, you're legal, you're legal. We don't have the power to strike down laws, but we can certainly free people. And then the states would follow. And frankly, I think they should have done the same thing with the in the most technical sense, with the gay marriage decision. They should have said to this particular man, yes, your marriage is legal, regardless of what the state says. We find it in the Constitution. And then, you know, but not we're going to strike down the law or we're going to, you know, strike down the constitutional amendment in your state. Instead, we're basically going to shame your state into waking up. But again, you know, it would lock gay people out for another couple of years until the rest of the country caught up. But my concern is that the way they did it in Roe v. Wade has led to 40 years of backlash of people still saying, but there was no legislative process. I doubt this is going to be the case here, but I hope not.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
I'm not a big fan of the Supreme Court's exercising judicial supremacy, even on things that I agree with. Certainly not on things I disagree with. 15 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Robert in Bullhead City, Arizona. Hey, Robert. What's up? Thanks for watching Free Speech TV. Robert? Cannot hear Robert. Amy in Madison, Wisconsin, watching Free Speech TV on Roku. Hey, Amy. What's up?
I saw special about white terrorism in the United States.
Uh-huh.
And now when I see all these black churches being burned, the FBI let go all the FBI agents that had cases about white terrorism when they infiltrated.
Right. So your point? So
now there's no FBI capability of doing this.
Oh, yeah, there is. I guarantee you that the FBI is looking into this, and they're trying to track down these white terrorists and racial terrorists, whatever you want to call them. I guarantee you, Amy, they're working on this. Unless you know something I don't. I mean, what would stop them from doing it?
Okay, I just hope someone does news on this.
Yeah. I agree. I mentioned it at the opening of the show. It needs to be mentioned more often. In the last week, 3 black churches have been burned by arson. Another 3 apparently by accidents. We don't know. At least 2 out of the 3. One was hit by lightning. One was had the power lines taken down by a tree, and it caught on fire. But the third one, or the fourth one, we don't know. We just don't know. Amy, thank you for the call. Excellent points. Robert in Bullhead City, Arizona. You want to try it again, Robert?
Yes, sir. Can you hear me?
I do.
All right. Well, sir, we had just a little disagreement last week. I consider you a very well-informed man, and I appreciate that. But I wasn't allowed to finish my point as concerning the Palestinian state in Israel. There are over 14 Arab countries that can take the Palestinians in and allow Israel to have their sovereign state. Now, and the other point was, you said, should America give back the Indians, or I call them indigenous people, their country back? And I said, no, but you didn't let me finish. They should have the treaties that they were originally granted, that this country has broken every one of them under their so-called encroachment law, and then they basically rape the land for minerals. And, you know, that's all I wanted to say. It's like, for a minute that I would sound like a racist, but I'm just being basically a person with a certain understanding of where there is a balance. There needs to be a balance. And President Obama said that if Israel will allow the Palestinians to settle, Israel would be a more secure state. And, sir, I really disagree with that. Israel, as well as you, I know Syria, Libya, Jordan, and Egypt surround Israel, and only the Mediterranean Sea would be their outlet. So the 3 settlements should actually be given into the Arab country with their love.
Well, they've already done that. I mean, more than half of the population of Jordan is Palestinians. It's not what the people whose ancestors for generations lived in that area want. So I guess we're just going to have to agree to disagree on this, Robert. Thank you for cleaning up the Native American thing. Thank you. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you. Earl in Cedar Falls, Iowa. Hey, Earl, what's on your mind?
I'm calling about the DPP. Last night there was a program. It was with an interview with a woman who wrote the book Capitalism, a Ghost Story.
Mm-hmm.
This thing with the DPP, I think they just sold the farm. As far as
well, the TPP hasn't been passed yet. We can still fight that war when it comes.
Okay. My question would be with safety, food safety with the USDA, FDA, et cetera, if the food is, or our food safety, does that mean that we can get nuclear contaminated grass-fed Kobe beef from Japan, and will these treaties affect or override what our laws or our regulations?
Correct.
Public, will they override?
Yes. where this is why these should be called treaties and not trade agreements, because they actually they allow an independent tribunal of corporate lawyers to sue the United States and force us to change our laws. And the classic example, or the most recent example, was 2 weeks ago. The WTO ruled that our country of origin labeling on meat, we require by law that if meat comes in from outside the United States, that when the consumer buys it, there's a sticker on it that says this meat came from Argentina, or this meat came from, you know, wherever, Costa Rica or something. And they said that that's an illegal restraint of trade. And so Congress last week passed a law undoing their own law, and we no longer have country of origin labeling. So if you're concerned about grass-fed Kobe beef from Japan that's walking around with high levels of radioactivity in it, showing up at the burger stand near you or in your local supermarket's meat section, your concern is very valid, because now you will have no way of knowing where that beef came from.
Exactly. Yeah. And it's just, I guess, kind of the thought is it's more the motive is the profit as opposed to safety or anything. And with back to this book and her kind of overall end of the road isn't a rosy picture for the U.S. and these trade agreements and what it's done to India and the impact. And it's just, I don't think we as a society or people in the U.S. see how detrimental this is going to end up for the U.S.
Yeah.
As far as trade, our jobs, they're just selling us out.
Yeah.
For the corporations and the politicians as well. They're nothing but just, I can't even.
Yeah, no, it's, I don't disagree with you at all, Earl. And you can thank the Supreme Court for all of this. The decision in 1976 that was led by Lewis Powell, who wrote the Powell memo about how corporations need to basically take over the political structure of America. In 1976, in the Buckley case, the Supreme Court said it is legal to buy politicians. We're going to overturn not only all the reforms that were done in 74 in the wake of the Nixon scandals, but, you know, with Citizens United, the court overturned all the way back to 1907, the Tillman Act that Teddy Roosevelt got passed, which made it a felony for corporations to give money to federal candidates for office. So it's a terrible mess, and it's a consequence of money in politics, and we've got to get that money out of politics. Earl, thank you for the call. Charles, driving through Arkansas. Hey, Charles, what's up?
Mr. Hartman, hey, sir, big fan, man. I've been listening to you for years.
Thank you.
Even when you were, I think you were in San Diego, and we lost our progressive talk station there a few years ago. I don't know if we ever got it back, but I got Sirius in the truck now. But I know your time is valuable, but I wanted to get with you about, did you hear, what's her name with the Adam's apple, Ann Coulter?
Yeah.
She called Nikki Haley a minority, because Nikki Haley, she handled the Charleston situation. She was real smooth about it, real cooperative, but I think, I'm wondering if she's setting herself up. So maybe she could be picked as a female vice president. Because, see, we got Hillary in there, and I think they need a female. Carly Farina, look like they're not paying no attention to her. But Nikki Haley, they would pay a little attention to her. But I want to get your opinion on that.
Yeah. I disagree with Nikki Haley on virtually all of her politics. She's a hard right-wing Republican and you know, has been, always, and will be. She is the daughter of immigrants from India. And so she is a minority, both as a female and as, although women are technically a majority in this country. But in some ways they're considered a protected minority, but also as a person of Indian heritage, as in India, not as in Native American. So, it wouldn't surprise me if she showed up on somebody's ticket on the Republican side, you know, a Walker-Haley ticket or a Bush-Haley ticket. It wouldn't surprise me at all. Charles, thanks for the call. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, I got a minute to the break. What's up?
Not a problem, Professor. The word that Earl was looking for is corporate prostitutes. That's who our politicians are. They are corporate prostitutes. Now, Greece, what if Greece were to say to the EU, we're not going to roll with you guys no more. You guys are affiliated, associated with the IMF Bank. You guys have poor ethics, principles, and practices. We're going to go with the BRICS Bank. All right? What would something like that do?
That's an interesting thing. This is the new bank that basically China was behind setting up, that Brazil, Russia, India, China, et cetera, they've set up their own version of the World Bank. That may well be what Tsipras and Putin were talking about a couple of weeks ago when they had their several-hour meeting. I have no idea. It would be very, very interesting. It would be... I wonder to what extent we would think that that was, you know, like the Soviet Union funding Cuba, you know, that that was some kind of an offensive thing. I don't know, but I suspect that there's a bunch of shoes that have yet to drop, and we need to keep an eye on this. Morris, thanks for the call. Very, very good question. I wish I knew the answer. It's 28 minutes past the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
28 minutes past the hour. Anything goes summer. We'll be back with your calls right after this. Now, this is interesting. There's an MIT professor, Sanjay Sarma, who says he helped invent the Internet of Things. And, you know, where you've got sensors all over your house, and, you know, the smoke detector and the refrigerator and everything, they're all wired together, and the temperature comes up when you get home and it goes down when you go away, and, you know, all these kind of things. And he's saying, you know, it's all fine as long as you don't connect your home to the Internet. But if you do, then anybody can come into your home and basically run it and watch you and listen to you and anything else you want. And that's kind of creepy. That's actually considerably creepy. He says, the truth is the Internet of Things isn't some futuristic thing. We're already surrounded by more than hundreds of systems that are networks of things. If your car is relatively modern, it has more than 100 sensors, all connected over an internal network. A factory may have thousands of sensors. Okay. Lowell in Salem, Oregon. Hey, Lowell. Thanks for listening to Sirius. What's on your mind?
Was that me, Tom?
That's you.
Oh, okay. Sorry, you're a little distant there in the microphone. So I wanted to let you know, I contacted my senator, Ron Wyden, and I'd recommend all your listeners do as well, especially the pro-free trade ones, and get them to explain to you why the WTO ruling is a good thing, because, you know, since they're so pro-free trade, they must have a good reason why we can't know what country our beef, pork, or chicken comes from.
Right. Yeah. Or any other meat we decide to eat.
Isn't fish excluded on that? On the ruling I saw, it was only listed pork, chicken, or beef.
Oh, did they? I haven't read the actual ruling. I didn't know if it would include things like goat and camel and horse meat, and I mean, there's a lot of kinds of specialty meats that people eat, or if they would consider seafood a meat. I think that, you know, if the people of the United States, if the representatives of the people of the United States said, we want to know where our food is coming from, and we passed a law saying we would like to know where our food is coming from, and then the WTO says, no, you can't know where your food is coming from, that's an illegal restraint of trade. I think, Lowell, your suggestion to call these 13 Democrats in the Senate, or the 20-some-odd Democrats, 24, 28, whatever it was, in the House who voted in favor of Fast Track, call them up and say, why is it a good thing that the WTO just said that I am not, as an American citizen, allowed to know where my meat is coming from? And you called Wyden's office. What did they say?
Well, they said they would get me a response from Wyden, and they took my home address, and so they'll send me – supposedly I'll – get some kind of a, you know, letter saying how great free trade is, and
right, get some kind of a form letter.
The question, which is the way they usually do it.
Yeah. Well, when you get a response, let us know, would you?
Will do.
Okay, Lowell. Thanks
a
lot.
Thanks a lot.
And good on you for being an activist like this. Jeff in San Francisco. Hey, Jeff, what's up? Jeff in San Francisco? He's been on hold a little too long. I think we are dropping packets here. Sophia in Maysville, Kentucky. Sophia, can you hear me?
Yes, I can, Tom.
Great. What's on your mind?
Quick question for you and or Shano. When SCOTUS ruled that states could opt out of Medicaid expansion, did they rule unconstitutionally regarding the 14th Amendment in that they said states could deny equal protection of the law?
That's a good question. And Shano just said equal protection doesn't apply across states. But,
okay, because it says no state shall pass any law denying equal protection of the laws.
Right. I'm more with you, Sophia. I think that if you consider Medicaid, a right, or even a benefit, and your legislature said no and another legislature said yes, then you've got two different states that are setting different standards, and that's not equal protection under the law. But maybe there's, Shane, do you want to get in on this conversation? You don't have a mic. Okay. All right. Well, you can.
Next time.
Yeah. There you go. I think they should have just left the law as it was. I mean, this was John Roberts' cut the baby in half kind of thing. And, let's make it voluntary. And it's unfortunate because people are dying as a result of this. As Mayor O'Neill, the guy who, the Republican mayor of Belhaven, South Carolina, walked all the way here to Washington, D.C. to tell us about. So, Sophia, thank you for the call. Andrea in Palm Springs, California. Hey, Andrea, what's up?
Good morning, Tom. Just before I get to the same-sex marriage, I need to tell you about a little cartoon by Harry Bliss. It's called Bliss, and it's of Bernie Sanders standing very defiantly, and the shirt he has on is an underdog. Remember the underdog cartoon?
You have nothing to fear. Underdog is here.
Yes, I love it. You need to find that. So anyway, when you were mentioning with the same-sex marriage decision, and perhaps because of what happened after Roe v. Wade, that the states might, continue to undermine it. First of all, I think that won't happen because people's minds are being changed across the country. But also in the Loving decision, which was virtually identical in the sense that it made all across the land, the law of the land to allow interracial marriage.
Right.
If they had allowed that to go state by state, there are southern states to this day that would outlaw interracial marriage, I'm sure, if it were put up to a vote.
I think you're right.
And so it settled it. And would you want to have seen the Loving decision go the way this decision went?
I don't think it's quite that simple. I think if the Loving decision had been, okay, you, Mr. Loving and Mrs. Loving, you're legal to be married in, it was Virginia, right? You are legal to be married in Virginia. That what would have happened is in all these other states, you would have seen case after case after case coming to the courts. And now that the Supreme Court has established the standard, the courts would be saying to every person who challenged the miscegenation laws, or in this case, the gay marriage laws or bans, that the courts would have said, okay, you're married. And eventually, I don't think you'd have seven states that would still be outlawing miscegenation, interracial marriage. But like I said, what I'm laying out is what I think was Alexander Hamilton's original understanding of what the Supreme Court did and how it did it. And in cases like Loving or Brown or Roe or in this gay marriage case, I'm very pleased that the Supreme Court ruled the way they did, and that they're applying it to everyone. I mean, historian part of me, or the whatever.
Right.
My concern is that we have an unelected body of lifetime appointees who now have seized power, which is greater than that was granted by the founders and the framers to the elected body. In other words, they can strike down a law that Congress makes, or they can create a whole new law or a whole new doctrine out of thin air. And they have done it over and over and over again. They did it in Buckley. They did it in Citizens United.
Yes.
And I would say that in aggregate, if you look at the history of the Supreme Court, and I think Ian Millhiser does a really good job of documenting this in his new book, The Supreme Injustice. In aggregate, the Supreme Court has been a regressive force in our country. There have been really only two times in the history of the country where it's been a progressive force, and one was the Warren Court. I forget what the other was. But generally, they've done far more harm than good. I mean, you go all the way back to Dred Scott, and so that's where I'm at.
One other thought I had was in terms of to illustrate how reactionary we are now relative to both Roe v. Wade and Loving. Loving was 9-0. Roe v. Wade was 7-2.
Right.
And this one was just, as close as you can get. And that's
right.
That is disturbing.
Yeah, it is. It is. It absolutely is. And, but figuring out the appropriate role of the Supreme Court is something that I think that we have to come to terms with. Otherwise, we're no longer a democracy or a republic. We are basically a kingdom. Mm-hmm. The Supreme Court, no European country has a court that can strike down laws. And the monarchs of the European countries that still have kings and queens, England, Norway, Belgium, whatever the long list is, those kings and queens don't have the power to strike down laws. Laws are made directly by the representatives of the people, and if the courts disagree with those laws, they can assert that on an individual basis, and they become a moral force in the society. But the laws have to be changed by the lawmakers. That's their job. And we have chosen not to do that, and the result of that is that now our entire political process is corrupted by money because the Supreme Court decided that they were going to create rules for all of us that no Congress ever voted for, to say
right.
Money is speech, corporations are people, and no Congress ever would vote for it. No president would ever sign it. So we now have law and doctrine in this country, as much good as they might have done in Roe and Loving. We have law and doctrine in this country that's doing, frankly, far more harm than had they not even decided those cases, in my opinion. I think eventually those things would have come along. So we'll see. We'll see. I mean, I realize my position on the court is an outlier. Most legal scholars disagree with me. They think, this is what we've got. This is what we should work with. And if you don't like the court, then elect somebody from a particular political party. But I think that's the stakes are way too high for that. Andrea, thank you for the call. It's 15 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The argument that I just made, by the way, is the same argument that Mike Huckabee is making, which puts me in very uncomfortable company. Welcome back. Denise in Calumet, Michigan, watching Free Speech TV. Hey, Denise, what's on your mind?
Well, something, Tom? I came to the conclusion that small town America, with all these hospital takeovers by these corporations, the local people that get these jobs as CEOs and COOs of these hospitals have started to act and become, in our communities, modeled after the 1% of the country.
Hmm.
They just take over the school boards, the Republican, the richest people in towns. They even fired our hockey coach because the CEO's son couldn't make the team. And the hockey coach, 30 years, 6 state championships, the whole nine. I mean, the best coach.
He offended a billionaire, so they fired him?
Yeah. They donate all this money to the hockey programs under the hospital's name now that it's corporate.
Right.
The CEO rides around in a new car from the hospital every year, takes all these people on hockey trips with it, probably uses the hospital gas card. But when his son got to high school, he couldn't make the team. So what they did was they went to the school board and made our hockey coach resign.
Did they get a new coach who put the kid on the team?
Yep. Yep.
Jeez.
And now the coaches, we're trying to get the coach's job back. But the coach was, the reason they said you make the kids skate too hard. How can you play hockey if you can't skate?
Right.
So it's ridiculous. And I think these small towns all around America are probably, these rich people are trying to enact or act like the 1% of the whole country.
Well, they are. I mean, this is you don't have to be fabulously rich to be in the top 1%. You have to have an income over $300,000 a year or net assets of, I think, over about $1 million. And there's a lot of Americans who fall into that. Not a huge number, but hundreds of thousands. But, this privilege of wealth is used and abused on a regular basis. Was this in Calumet that this happened, Denise?
Yes. And
wow.
Our hockey coach is so good, and he had so many state championships that people from downstate would have never come up here to play hockey at so far, but they had such respect for our hockey program.
Wow.
And, you know, we would make it downstate all the time. It's just, you know, it's just incredible the things they're doing.
Yeah.
And, you know, just ripping off the public and not, you know, everything has to be according to their rules and whatever they do. And we had a meeting, and the general public went to the meeting, and we were trying to get the coach's job back. And I just heard today that one of the board members was at the local uppity golf course and said, oh, we're just going to ignore this.
Ignore what?
Ignore the people that are trying to get the hockey coach's job back.
Oh, geez.
The board, they met with us. We read our situation to them, and they treated us badly, and they just said, well, we're just going to ignore this.
We're going to go with the rich guy instead of the people.
Yeah, we're going to go with the rich Republicans.
Yeah. The fact that people feel entitled like this tells me that they know that they live in an oligarchy, and you know, that oligarchic sentiment has descended all the way from Washington, D.C. down to your local school board. That's astonishing. Denise, thank you for the call, and thanks for sharing your story with us. That's terrible. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Mike in Elkhorn, Wisconsin. Hey, Mike, you got a problem with Scott Walker?
Oh, hey, Tom. Good to talk to you.
Thank you.
Yeah, I do. I have a couple problems with Scott Walker. He's doling out money to private companies that he thinks are going to win, and $1.2 million went to two different companies that just went belly up in the past month. But on the other hand, he ordered the DOT to stop picking up dead deer off the interstate because it was costing him $70,000 a year.
You're kidding.
So every mile or so on the interstate, there's a dead deer laying there rotting into the pavement, and it's black and disgusting, and he says don't pick them up.
Jeez.
So I think people should know what's going on with Governor Walker.
Yeah. You should make some lawn signs that say "Brought to you by Scott Walker" and just put one next to every deer.
On the deer, yeah.
Yeah.
They used to pay private citizens $24 to pick up a deer.
Yeah.
If the DOT didn't have time to do it, you know,
uh-huh.
Those people will go and get them in the next day after they get hit, so that they are usable.
Yeah.
But these things are carnage that the birds won't even eat anymore.
Yeah. Yeah, that's astonishing. Mike, thanks for the call, or thanks for the enlightenment. Michael in Bethesda, Maryland. Hey, Michael, what's up?
Hey, how are you?
Good.
So I was visiting a friend yesterday. I live in Washington, D.C., and she works for the Department of Agriculture. And she's from the Soviet Union, so she's very, very paranoid about any restrictions on free trade because, you know, in the Soviet Union they had no free trade whatsoever, and it was horrible for the economy. But I had an argument with her about the TPP because I'm, as a progressive, you know, I'm against it. I support the unions. I don't want to lose any more jobs here. But she says that free trade will actually increase jobs because she acknowledges that most of the money from exports will be going to the CEOs and the top 1%. But she says that more exports means more work, and more work to be done. More work to be done means more jobs. So do you think that there's some truthfulness to that?
If that was true, I mean, you know, there's truth to that logic. If you have more exports, you have more factories making those exports, and you do have more jobs. And back before we entered into these so-called free trade deals, we had a lot of factories. We had 63,000 more factories than we have right now just in 2000. And nobody was keeping track prior to that, but I'd guess that we've probably lost several hundred thousand factories since NAFTA. At the very least. At least 100,000. So, if her logic, you know, if the effect of the trade deals was that it increased the exports of the United States, yes, she would be right. But the effect of every single one of these trade deals up until now, and Obama is telling us this one's going to be different, but you can't read it. The effect of every one of these trade deals up until now has been to diminish the number of factories in the United States and increase the number of factories overseas. We've made America poorer and China richer.
Do you trust Obama? Do you trust him?
I trust Obama in a lot of things. I think in this case, I think he's being lied to by Mickey Froman, his trade negotiator. Or, you know, he thinks that this is the way to do it, that the whole world needs to be lifted up and America needs to be dropped down. I don't know. You know, I honestly don't know, and I have a really hard time speculating about his motivations. Michael, thanks for the call. Helen in Ithaca, New York, listening on 1470 AM. Hey, Helen, what's up? Helen? I'm sorry, Helen. Marcella in Reno, Nevada. Can you hear me, Marcella? Or Marceline?
Marceline, yes. Yeah. I'm calling about the David Attenborough interview with President Obama that an earlier caller told you about.
Yeah, I got a link to it. I found it.
And it is repeated tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock on DirecTV.
Oh, okay. Great. I'll check it out. Marceline, okay. Thank you. Thank you for the heads up on that. Suzanne in Corinth, Vermont. Hey, Suzanne, what's on your mind today?
Hi. I think you were saying earlier that you were, well, I'm a Bernie supporter, but I would certainly work for Hillary, and I think you were saying something to that effect.
Yes.
But you're not going to get involved, and I don't blame you, you know, right now. But I, too, after hearing Claire McCaskill's words about Bernie, I think she even said he was a liberal, like that was a bad thing.
She said he was a socialist.
Okay. And I heard that socialist part, and then I thought there was even something about liberal, but, like, you know, God forbid.
Yeah.
But anyway, I ended up calling her office in D.C. and the Hillary Clinton Information Office, kind of whatever that is. I'm not sure. Found the number online. But I thought that the Hillary Clinton camp should know that that tactic, that approach is not something that's going to bring, you know, it's very divisive, and it certainly won't help bring out the youth vote, which is just one of many votes that we need in November 2016. That it's, you know, just a really terrible approach. I was pretty appalled.
I agree. And I think that Democrats, you know, Reagan figured this out. The Republicans figured this out in 1980 after the Barry Goldwater years and the wars that they had, and Barry Goldwater getting booed at the Nelson Rockefeller getting booed at the 64 convention. And all this, I mean, the internecine warfare. Reagan said the 11th commandment is thou shalt not criticize a fellow Republican. And they've had pretty good discipline about that, with the exception of Rand and Ron Paul, for 35, 40 years. Democrats need to adopt a similar thing. And I am on this program. I can give you a list of things that I don't like about anybody, but I want to stay on the positive until after the primaries. Because when you start hammering the negative on people, it causes people to say, screw it, I'm not going to vote. And this is a really important election. Suzanne, thank you for the call, and thank you for your activism in calling those offices. I think it's a mistake, too, for the Clinton campaign to call Bernie names. I just think it's a mistake. Anyhow, we'll be back tomorrow. Thanks so much for being with us today, and don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. It actually requires you to show up. So tag, you're it. We'll see you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit tomhartman.com.